hopes through music. That's next time on Latino USA.
Saturday evenings at 8 on AM 580.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It is our final week of programming here on Tell Me More, and we wanted to draw attention to the kinds of stories that have been important to us in our past 7 years on the air. One of the show's missions has always been to highlight international stories that you might not be hearing anywhere else, or perhaps in a depth that goes beyond coverage in other places. And so today, we'd like to hear from those who have helped make that happen. For us and for many listeners, frankly, NPR's coverage of Africa is synonymous with the name of Ophebia Quist Arkton. Over the years, she's brought us news from Sudan, Ghana, South Africa, and of course, Dakar, Senegal, her base. So we were very happy to be able to hear from her one last time in this venue anyway. Ophebia, welcome back. Thanks so much for joining us once again.
Greetings, and this time from London.
So we'd like to talk about some of the stories that we're not hearing much about that you'd like to share with us in a minute, but I would like to start with some news out of West Africa. A lot of people are paying attention to this growing outbreak of Ebola that's killed more than 650 people so far. Now, this is the largest number of deaths ever recorded. It's put countries like Guinea, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and now Nigeria on notice. And we're hearing even that some medical workers now have been affected by this and they're testing positive for the virus. Can you just tell us a bit more about Why do people think that this has spread in this way at this particular time? And anything you can tell us about this?
Michelle, the main thing is that there's a lot of fear, a lot of disinformation, a lot of rumor, suspicion, and that is unfortunately helping to fuel Ebola in West Africa. You've mentioned the three countries. The epicenter in Guinea started back in February and then spread across Guinea's borders to Sierra Leone and Liberia. And also in Africa, there are rituals and ceremonies when people die. Burials, for example. You wash your dead. There's a lot of intimacy. And Ebola is spread through close contact with bodily fluids. So that is one of the ways that the virus is spreading. But many people are saying, no, but we have to bury our dead people this way. But if the person, your loved one, died of Ebola, that cannot be.
Just briefly, Ophebia, are these governments taking any particular steps to try to, you know, intervene here?
Well, we've heard Liberia, which is one of the countries most affected, has now said it is closing its border crossings to try and stop the free flow of human beings across the borders. I've heard in my own country, Ghana, that steps are being taken. But many people are saying more has got to be done to contain this disease. The incubation period is anything from 2 days to 21 days. West Africa, you can cross how many borders within a day?
So as we've mentioned, Ophebia, over the years, you really have brought Africa to life for so many of our listeners and certainly for us. You know, in the past 7 years, the narrative about the continent has really changed. I mean, in 2000, The Economist dubbed it the hopeless continent. But now we are hearing, you know, Africa is rising and so forth. Could you just pick out one story over the last 7 years that you feel you most want to be sure that people remember or hear about? I know that's hard, but if you would.
It is hard, but let me first say that we knew that Africa was not a hopeless continent. That infuriated me, Michelle, that, you know, because even when that cover came out on The Economist, Africa was not a hopeless continent. Yes, there are patches of hopelessness. Yes, there are areas of conflict, but there are so many Africans who are making the continent tick that we don't hear enough about. And mea maxima culpa, I blame myself amongst other journalists for not focusing enough on these stories. But of course, we have to cover the conflict and the wars and the blood, as well as the stories that make people smile, make people laugh, and make people sit up and say, hey, is that happening in Africa? That is absolutely fantastic. I'm going to give you two stories. One was a desperate story back in 2008, was it 2009, 2008, in Guinea, that women were assaulted in the most brutal way, sexually assaulted in public, in a stadium after soldiers had recently taken power And these women, amongst others, were protesting, saying, no, it has to, we have to have an end of military rule. We must go back to an elected democratic government in Guinea. They were corralled in this stadium. And then the women were sexually brutalized with machetes, with bayonets, with rifles. Now, you're going to say, well, Ophébia, have you followed up on this story? And I'll tell you why I haven't, Michelle. Because the women involved, it was very difficult to get to them in the first place. You know, a Muslim majority country, very conservative. And these women found it hugely difficult to, women all over the world, but particularly here, to discuss these stories. They confided in me and I shared their story. But years later, to go back and to try and find them when many of them hadn't told their husbands, their children, their sisters, anyone, except this one health worker, psychologist who was trying to help them. So that's why I haven't gone back and followed up on this story. Now, that shows the brutality of Africa, but it's much more than that. Also, you have an African woman who is teaching mostly young women how to become mechanics. The Lady Mechanic Initiative, it's called. It's in Nigeria. She's based in the main city, Lagos, and has branches in different parts of the country. I'm sure you get women mechanics in the US, but in Africa, it's not habitual to see women underneath cars covered in black fuel oil. But the young women I spoke to, Michelle, were absolutely delighted to be tinkering with and fixing cars for men and women. And they said, you know, this is my calling. This is what I'm good at. So barriers are being broken down and African women are rising. And that was a wonderful story that I truly enjoyed.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with NPR's Africa correspondent, Ophébia Quist-Arkton. She's with us from London. You know, one thing that I think a lot of people who have never traveled to the continent will have noticed here is that the artistic voices of Africa are really achieving a new prominence. Would you agree?
I often say, Michelle, if it were our writers and artists and creators who were leading Africa, perhaps our continent wouldn't have so many problems. If we had these people who create and bring light and hope and, you know, focus on what is important on the continent. If they were in leadership posts, perhaps Africa would all round be doing better. And there are so many of them. I can't name them all, but let me just give you one example, may I?
Sure.
Tandiswa Mazwai. I guess we call her a singer because she is a musician, but she is so much more, a hugely talented young woman who could have done anything in this world. She is so intelligent, but she is using music to rediscover her roots and the roots of many in South Africa. And then she is bringing the old songs, you know, giving them a makeover, a new look, a new sound. Can we hear perhaps Inchilonchilo? That's one of the songs one would associate with the late Miriam Makeba, the mother of African music. But here is Tandiswa Mazwai, Tandiswa's version.
Well, Ophébia, you know, before we let you go, what about you? What are you fascinated by at the moment? How do you stay at it? How do you stay encouraged and motivated? I mean, you see so much suffering. I mean, you see a lot of joy, too, and a lot of great progress, but you see so much suffering too. What keeps you going? Do you mind if I ask?
Africa is just such an extraordinary continent. Full stop. Period, I should say in American. I mean, just there is so much going on. There is so much humanity. There is so much good. you know, people talk about hatred, about all the negative things, but you step onto the continent of Africa and you are uplifted. That's how I feel every time I land in Dakar or Accra or Nairobi or Johannesburg, wherever it is on the continent. Let me just quote a friend of mine, Sobel Ngom, he's called. He's from Senegal. Now, he has joined President Obama's Young Leaders Initiatives. So he spent the past, what, 6 weeks or so in the U.S.? Mm-hmm. And President Obama actually quoted Sobel at a town hall meeting that he had with these young people. He said, "Here I have met Africa. The Africa I always believed in. She's beautiful, she's young, she's full of talent and motivation and ambition." And President Obama said, "That's a good description." And that's how I feel. Well, sometimes Africa is not so young and not so beautiful, but it's an extraordinary continent. And I say to all of you, if you have the opportunity, don't listen to the doomsayers. Listen to those of us who say, Africa is champion. Africa is a continent that when you get there, you will realize that it just lifts you up. And there are so many good people. That's why I cover Africa for NPR.
Ophibia Quist-Ogden is NPR's Africa correspondent, and we caught up with her at NPR's London studios. Ophibia, thank you so much for all of your contributions to the program throughout the years, and hopefully we'll keep talking.
It's been a pleasure and an honor. Thank you. To tell me more.
Coming up, tougher laws targeting homosexuality in some parts of the world have forced people to choose between their country and being true to themselves.
It's a very tense time to go back, and this is very discomforting to me because, of course, I love my home, I love my family, but now Jamaica to me feels like a prison.
Gay activists from Jamaica and Nigeria on fighting for their rights and their safety. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Your days are busy.
Work, school, errands, kids.
It never stops.
And the news never stops either.
You can keep up between Morning Edition and All Things Considered with Here and Now. Hi, it's Robin Young.
And Jeremy Hobson. Here and Now brings you breaking news, developing stories, the latest in the arts and innovation.
Asking tough questions, unpacking complex issues.
From across the country and around the world.
Join us.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
Support for WILL comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the standard all-wheel drive Subaru Outback with an EPA highway rating of 29 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at their showroom on Route 45 in Savoy or at SubaruofChampaign.com.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. As we continue our focus on international news this hour, we go to Mexico. We've often turned to Alfredo Corchado to keep us up to date on our southern neighbor. He's lived and worked in Mexico for some 20 years now. He's the bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News and author of the memoir Midnight in Mexico. Recently, though, he's been spending time at the Guatemala-Mexico border following the journey of would-be immigrants. He joins us now from Mexico. Welcome back. Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure, Michelle.
Tell us about the recent trip that you took. What led you to it, and what did you find there?
Well, I've been traveling for the last 5 days from the Guatemala-Mexico border, following the journey of the train known as the Beast. And this is the train that many of the poorest Central Americans use to come across the Mexican landscape atop the train. It's a clean, harrowing trip for people. And obviously these days it's even more dangerous because you have so many children. Mexico had said that they were going to double up its efforts to stop people from getting on the train. And at least in the places I went to, it's working. I mean, there were not trains leaving, which meant more of these migrant shelters are packed. People are stuck. So less people are getting to the border, to the Texas border. The real crisis as well is now in the Mexican Guatemalan border and throughout these communities along the railroad.
You know, this is an enormous story, I think, on, you know, both sides of the border right now. But what are some of the other big stories that you've covered over the years?
You know, I came to Mexico 20 years ago thinking I wanted to cover the democratic opening of the country. And I had covered this, I mean, I started covering this back in the 1980s when states like Chihuahua were out there trying to claim their homeland. They were trying to make democracy a reality. The first part of my career, I was covering those stories, and suddenly, obviously, the more Mexico reached this opening, the more there was a power vacuum, and then the drug cartels came in and kind of took over big regions of the country. So I think for the last 10 years, the big story for me has been covering the drug cartels, not as a police story, not as a narco story, but as to kind of showcase how communities were not ready for this opening up democracy. And suddenly you had the mayor's office, you have police departments, you have entire journalism rooms that fell to organized crime. And the result, you know, more than 100,000 people either killed or disappear in over 7 years.
I'm not sure people understand how dangerous it can be to be a journalist in Mexico. Why do you stay at it?
First of all, Mexico is one of the most dangerous places to practice journalism. More than 70 of my colleagues have been killed. Total number, when you put in the disappearance, the number really hovers over 100. I want to believe that even though I'm Mexican-born, I was born in Mexico and left when I was at the age of 6. As a kid, I always wanted to come back to Mexico. I mean, I always felt that my life had been interrupted, and I wanted to come back and connect with my culture, connect with my language. But I think, you know, my biggest advantage is that I came back as an American citizen. I think having that U.S. passport has meant having perhaps the freedom that my colleagues in Mexico don't have, being able to have protection, being able to call my editor and saying, listen, things are kind of crazy, I need to get back to the U.S. Having that flexibility, having those options, I think, have kept me rather safe, even though I did receive some threats, and one of them actually forced me out of the country back in 2008. It's something that just kind of sticks with you. But it's also, it's this whole childhood dream of one day coming back, being able to tell those stories, and hopefully being able to sort of bridge the gap between the American audience and the Mexicans, you know, serve as a bridge between two countries, if you will.
Is there a story that you really hope will stick with people, particularly, I would have to say, in your American audience?
I think the story that will always stick with me and the story that moved me so much was the birthday massacre. This is January 2010, when young kids, teens, were celebrating a birthday, many of them athletes. The parents had said, listen, celebrate right across the street so we can keep an eye on you. And drug cartels, hitmen with the wrong information, got the wrong party, come in and they shoot the place. I mean, they hit 30 people. 15 of them were teens. Many of them were killed. I mean, 15 were killed. Three or four of them were members of a football team. And that story really marked me because I think it was at a time when I had decided I wanted to cover something else. I wanted to maybe cover arts in Dallas or maybe cover the Dallas Cowboys, but just get out of this story. I mean, I think it was overtaking me. And that was the saddest story I had ever covered. I mean, I always think of that day when it was cloudy, it was about to rain, and I kept thinking, oh my God, I hope it rains, I hope it rains, because you couldn't hold back the tears. And then the rain started, and I looked around, I think a lot of my colleagues, I mean, I think we all started crying because of the magnitude of the story. But it was in those very sad, hopeless moments that I began to see also the best of Mexicans. I began to see how Mexicans decided we can maybe leave for the United States, maybe seek political asylum, but we're staying, and we're staying to try to build community. Maybe not change the entire city of Ciudad Juarez, but at least change their neighborhoods. And anytime I have doubts about Mexico, you know, where Mexico is going, I still to this day drop by in that neighborhood and I talk to neighbors, and it reminds you why you're a journalist, and it reminds you why, you know, of the importance of telling stories. Certainly for me, it's become my own, I guess, crossing or my own turning point.
Hmm. Alfredo Corchado is Mexico bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News. He's author of the memoir Midnight in Mexico. We reached him at his office there. Alfredo Corchado, thanks so much for joining us. Thank you so much for your contributions to the program throughout. We hope you'll stay in touch.
Michelle, I have loved talking to you, and I look forward to staying in touch.
To a related story now, in the 7 years that we've been on the air, we've reported on big changes in the lives of LGBT people in the U.S. Same-sex marriage is now legal in 20 states here in the U.S. The success of shows like Modern Family and Orange is the New Black have brought gay characters and transgender characters into the spotlight. But we've also been paying close attention to movements opposing LGBT rights in other parts of the world. For example, Nigeria passed a law earlier this year that could mean 14-year prison terms for anybody in a same-sex union, and 10 years for anybody who, quote, promotes homosexuality, unquote. We've also reported on the atmosphere in places like Jamaica, where guests have told us that a hostile legal environment and a hostile cultural environment have put their lives at risk. We thought we'd check in on two of our international guests who helped us report on these issues. Maurice Tomlinson is a Jamaican activist and lawyer who moved from Jamaica to Canada because he no longer felt safe in his homeland. And Ibisi Alimi was granted asylum in the UK after years of harassment following his decision to come out on Nigerian television a decade ago. Both men have shared their stories with us before, so we wanted to check back in with them one more time. Welcome back to you both. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Maurice, let me start with you. You were a successful lawyer in Jamaica, and I remember you were telling us that you really had no intention of coming out. Can you just briefly remind us of why you did?
The major LGBT group on the island, JFLAG, they needed a lawyer to provide human rights training for the members of the LGBT community, what their rights were, how to respond when they were arrested, etc. When I started helping these people, I started hearing their stories. I was largely ignorant of how bad things were because I lived in a bubble. So when I heard their stories, I started writing about it in the newspapers. And one thing led to another, and I became identified as the, as we say in Jamaica, the Batman lawyer. Hmm. and that was that.
And threats ensued. You felt like you couldn't practice your profession anymore. It was that you couldn't live. You really, literally, didn't feel you could live there anymore. You were under threat.
Things became very dangerous when I married my Canadian husband. That was when things really got bad. I think, you know, my marriage crossed the line, and that was when the threats became more vocal and seriously very dangerous.
At ABC, what about you? Would you remind us again briefly of why you finally decided you had to leave Nigeria?
Problems started when I had my breakthrough in acting, and I had a show on TV, and then there was this huge interest in my private life, so much so my relationship with men. For me, the most frightening part of it was the night that my house was broken into, and I was almost killed. I was tied up. I was beaten for over 1.5 hours, going to 2 hours. I still feel goose pimples all over my skin, and it was such a very frightful night for me. And I had no choice after that night than to run away from Nigeria.
You know, there's been a lot of attention on Nigeria's anti-gay laws when the president, Goodluck Jonathan, signed them earlier this year. But since then, there's been so much news about the extremist group Boko Haram and the hundreds of kidnapped schoolgirls. I wonder, did that cause people to... I'm wondering what your associates are telling the people who you're connected to who are still there, are telling you about whether that's changed their lives in any way. Are people kind of rethinking the consequences of this kind of extremism or not? I mean, do you see my question?
I get your question. And I think in a way this has changed the dynamics around the conversation about the same-sex law that was signed in January. There's a bit of diversion from gay issues that the media will report every week now to talking about Boko Haram and dealing with, you know, the increasing number of people being killed via suicide bombers. But also there is the downside of it, of the news, the increasing news of victimization of LGBT people not getting into the media anymore because there's no space for it.
Hmm. I see. I see. So it's a return to invisibility.
Exactly.
Maurice, you do go back to Jamaica, but you don't stay. How does that sit with you?
Now I have a very strong security protocol when I go back to Jamaica, because the last time I went back to do work, I decided to go and do something social. I went out and was going to visit friends, and my car was recognized, and I was nearly mobbed. And since then, when I go back, I'm literally picked up by a dedicated driver, taken to the hotel where I am, you know, kept under wraps until it's time to go to court, when I do my matter, and then I go back to the airport and then fly out.
You don't even see your parents. I mean, you can't even see your family.
I have managed to do a few quick visits that are, I have to be unannounced. And I live on Facebook, and I can't make that known until post-event, because my mother has said, you know, it's, she's gotten a lot of threats, etc. And so she's asking me not to be visible when I'm there. So it's a very tense time to go back. And this is very discomforting to me, because, of course, I love my home, I love my family. But now Jamaica to me feels like a prison.
At ABC, I'm assuming that you can't go back at all, that that's not even part of your plan.
Going back to Nigeria feels like me trying to commit suicide, basically. You know, I'm always in the news. There's always something written about me in the media. Even, you know, my Facebook post or my tweet can become a news story. I'm not somebody that can sneak into the country and sneak out. So it's a very... it would be very difficult for me to try. But I miss Nigeria. I really want to go back home. I say this many times. I really want to be part of the solution to my country. But at the same time, I have to understand the reality that as of now, my country is telling me that they don't want me to be part of that solution. And I have to respect that.
Is there anything at ABC that anyone else can do to be helpful?
Doing something starts with engaging with people that are mostly affected by these laws and by this reality, which most times politicians, you know, will override our feelings or our opinion and start engaging most times in the wrong way with their fellow politicians from Nigeria, for example. I don't think this is a time for us to be raising funds or to be sending money or to be, you know, commercializing this whole issue. This is a time for us to understand the fact that, you know, at the end point of this law, of this brutality, human beings, and how do we support them, both emotionally, physically, and also how do we support their government, not tell them what to do, but support them to understand what the issues are. And I think that's the conversation that is missing.
Maurice, before we let you go, is there a final thought here? It sounds like you're doing well on a personal level, and you're able to practice in Canada, you're able to kind of live your life. But is there anything else that, it's really the same question to you, is there anything else that anyone else on the outside can do or say that would be helpful?
I take a different view to ADBC, because I think that, you know, it's great to engage with politicians, but the politicians themselves have said, at least in the Caribbean context, they will do absolutely nothing until we show them a poll, for example, that the level of homophobia is below 50%. That's what they've said to me. And the only way that's going to happen is if we have a level of awareness. So I believe people can support groups like LGBTI Aware, where we train police, media, healthcare workers, prison workers, you know, major opinion leaders about the basics of what it means to be LGBTI, so that destigmatizes, demystifies LGBTI people.
Are they open to it? Are they interested?
Yeah. At the last training we did in St. Lucia, you know, the police themselves, they, after we'd finished, they held a moot, which used as its theme, you know, as consenting adults, gays have the right to marry. And we didn't tell them to propose this moot. They developed it themselves, and they invited the public, and they researched it, and they had a dialogue. And the education has been phenomenal. But we need more of this, because, to be frank, I don't think the politicians are brave enough now in Africa or anywhere in the world to go against what is popular culture. So we need to work as activists
to try and change the popular culture in whatever means we can. And I think education is where we begin.
Maurice Tomlinson is a Jamaican lawyer. He's a gay rights activist. He joined us from the CBC's studios in Toronto, Canada. Adebisi Alimi is a Nigerian LGBT and HIV advocate. He's a fellow at the Aspen Institute, and he was with us from the BBC studios in London. Thank you both so much for speaking with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
It's a pleasure.
Coming up, when a young Ghanaian rapper tried to break into Brooklyn's hip-hop scene, it was hard to get people to listen.
The challenge is that when you're telling a story that is unorthodox, you know, and people aren't so familiar with it, it's hard to make it cool.
Blitz the Ambassador tells us why he thinks they're listening now. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children both in and out of school at wallacefoundation.org. From the estate of Miles Gatterman, whose bequest is a tribute to NPR's ongoing dedication to music and the arts. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working to build a culture of health for all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
We've done it. We've put together what we're calling the smartest afternoon in radio. On Saturday, August 9th, we're adding the Moth Radio Hour to our schedule at 1 o'clock, where it's in great company with This American Life at noon, Radio Lab at 2, the TED Radio Hour at 3, Weekend All Things Considered at 4, and Big Picture Science at 5. Get smart. Join us August 9th at noon when we launch the smartest afternoon in radio on WILL AM 580.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with New York Times foreign correspondent Rukmini Kalamaki about her investigation into Al-Qaeda's lucrative business of kidnapping for ransom. And we'll talk about the trove of Al-Qaeda documents she discovered in North Mali, documents left behind by the jihadists when they fled, and what they reveal about Al-Qaeda's operations. Join us.
Weekday mornings at 11 and again at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Our broadcast day is made possible in part by the Friends of WILL and by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting you to visit Promenade, the artfully affordable and exceptionally eclectic shop. More information on upcoming events is on KrannertCenter.com.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now, if you are a fan of Netflix's original series, Orange is the New Black, you are probably aware of how much actress Uzo Aduba brings to the program. She plays Litchfield inmate Suzanne Warren, known as Crazy Eyes, and her performance is tender, terrifying, aggressive, and vulnerable. Here she is talking about love.
It's like you become more you, which normally is like... But now it's okay, because the person, like whoever, they chose to take all that weird stuff, whatever's wrong or bad or hiding in you. Suddenly it's all right. You know? don't feel like such a freak anymore.
Critics have noticed her, too. She recently received her first Emmy nomination for Outstanding Guest Actress in a Comedy Series. So, you know, we had to catch up with her. Uzo Aduba is with us now. Welcome. Congratulations on everything.
Thank you very much. And thank you so much for having me.
I'm going to ask you to tell us your full name, if you don't mind.
No problem. My full name is Ozaamaka Aduba. My first name, it means the road is good.
The road is good. All right. And you were born in Massachusetts, but your family's from Nigeria. Yeah. And I read a story that at one point when you were in school, you wanted to change it because you said none of your classmates could pronounce it. Yeah. Instead, your mother had a very different perspective on that. Tell us what she said.
Yeah. I grew up in a very small town in Massachusetts, and it goes without saying that there weren't many Nigerian families in that town. And a lot of people couldn't say Ozaamaka. And so I came home from school one day and, you know, I said to my mother, she was busy cooking. I said, Mommy, can you call me Zoe? And she stopped and she turned and she looked to me and in her Igbo accent, she said, why? And I said, because no one can say Ozaamaka. And I thought Zoe was like a close switch up from Ozaamaka, Uzo for short, Uzo, Zoe. It was kind of sounded a little bit in the family, at least. And without skipping a beat, my mother, she said, if they can learn to say Tchaikovsky and Michelangelo and Dostoevsky, then they can learn to say Ozaamaka. And we never discussed it again.
Never discussed it again. No. You know, there's a theme here. I understand that actually on the day that you got this role, you were actually thinking of quitting acting. Is that true?
Yes, I actually did quit acting the day I got Orange is the New Black. You know, I'd been auditioning for film and television and taking a step away from the theater and was really aggressively pursuing it. And all I kept hearing over and over and over again was no at every audition. And I'm first generation. My family's from Nigeria. And I was feeling like my parents always wanted something. You know, they came here with an American dream. My mom, she really just wanted the best life for us. And I was wondering if I was just kind of wasting that life. And I'd gone to this audition for Blue Bloods and I got lost. And I thought it was a sign that I wasn't supposed to be doing this, that the universe, God, was telling me, this is not for you. You need to find something else and do that and live your life with purpose there. And so I really moved on in my heart. And about an hour or so later, I got the phone call that I had gotten Orange, which I had auditioned for about a month earlier.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you think that all of that informs the work now?
Absolutely. I think, first and foremost, for me, it reestablished my faith. It gave me an opportunity and a voice to speak and let my art live, which is all I've ever wanted to do. And somebody like Suzanne, who could easily be voiceless, I think it became even more passionate to make sure that her point of view and her voice be heard when I was working on the part.
In season two, we've really gotten to know a lot more about Suzanne and her story. Fascinating backstory. I hope I'm not spoiling anything for anybody to find out that she was adopted by a white family and really struggled to fit in. Is there anything that you think you've learned from her that you want to pass on to us in playing this character?
Absolutely. I think the thing that she's taught me more than anything is it's okay to be just you. You know, she, as different and as, you know, off the wall, and some of her choices might be so different from the ones that any of us might make in our life, she is 100% and authentically herself always, at all times. And she's not afraid to love hard, no matter what the cost. And that opening and openness of spirit, I think, is something that I will carry with me for the rest of my life.
So, you know, we're talking about global stories this hour, and we've been meeting people throughout this hour, of people who have touched the diaspora in many different ways and who live in the diaspora in many different ways. As I mentioned, you know, born here, roots there. Now you're at this very interesting place in kind of American celebrity and kind of dealing with that whole piece. Do you think you have some wisdom or guidance to share about whatever led you to this place at this time that you might want to pass on to other people?
Absolutely. When I moved to New York City, my mom, she dropped me off the train station and she stopped the car and she just said to me, she said, "Ozo, just work hard. I don't know what will come. I don't know when it will come. But if you work hard, I know something will come." And that stayed on my spirit. It's like seeped into the marrow of my soul that if I can just work hard, I don't know what the thing will be. Something will come. And the other part of it that she said, "I've never heard of nothing coming from hard work." And for me, that would be the thing that I would pass on. I've never heard of nothing coming from hard work. I've heard of nothing coming from nothing, but I've never heard of absolutely nothing coming from hard work. So regardless the industry you're going into, but if you can put your whole self into it and do the best job that you can do and try with all of your might, something will come.
Uzo Aduba plays Suzanne Crazy Eyes Warren on the Netflix original series Orange is the New Black. And she was kind enough to join us from our studios in New York City. Uzo Aduba, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you so much. And congratulations on your show. And I wish you all the best. I'm so thankful to be here in these last days.
As we wind down this program, we're going back to some of the stories and guests that have fascinated us over the years. One of the stories that we've returned to again and again is the story of the immigrant experience. And over the years, we've had many political debates about immigration, but we've also heard many moving stories told through firsthand accounts and literary works, films, and music. Today, we want to hear again from an artist who's telling the story of an African immigrant in the U.S. through hip-hop. He was born Samuel Basawule in Ghana. He became Blitz the Ambassador in Brooklyn after a detour studying marketing, of all things. His latest album, Afropolitan Dreams, takes the listener through his story, starting with The Arrival.
Now serving window number 3.
Welcome to the United States Immigration Center. Can I see your passport, green card, and birth certificate, please? And what is your occupation, sir? A rapper? A rapper? Okay.
Okay. We caught up with him last year when he released his EP, The Warm Up, and he promised to come back and tell us more, and he is true to his word, so... Your Excellency, Blitz the Ambassador, welcome back to the program. Thanks for joining us. Congratulations.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So now that the whole album is out and the story is out, tell me about the title, Afropolitan. Now, that's not a term you coined.
No, not at all. Actually, a lot of credit to Taye Selassie. She's an amazing author and a friend of mine. And she wrote an essay around 2005. In that essay, she used the term Afropolitan. And, you know, a lot of people have different definitions of it. I was looking for something that described who I was in terms of being young, being creative, and being global. But at the end of the day, I felt what the Afropolitan part of it really revolves around returning home.
In her essay, she writes about, you know, our funny blend of London fashion, New York jargon, African ethics, and academic successes. But one of the things that the CD makes clear is that those successes don't come without cost and without some struggle. You have a cut called Success. I just want to play a little bit.
No matter who you are, success is the best payback. Yeah. It's the beginning of a new era. Ambassador, tell the frauds I'm a torchbearer. Afropolitan dreaming, they fiending for that album. New Huey, Masekela, killing everything at random. We go to sleep in Tokyo and waking up in London. This is the life that we dreamt when we were grinding. They treated African rappers like, nope, you don't belong here. Now we blowing up and they like, hoop, something wrong here. Rocking
that so well, has it been that bad, really?
Well, I mean, it's a challenge, you know. The challenge is that when you're telling a story that is unorthodox and people aren't so familiar with it, it's hard to make it cool. And, you know, it's taking a lot of us, a lot of work, really trying to tell this African story and finding a way to do it here in America. It's not easy because, of course, this is a very, very closed society, really, and it views itself as the world. And so when you're bringing other world elements into this world, it's not the easiest thing to do. So it's been very interesting, but it's also been great because this is still one of the greatest platforms there is, springboards, you know. The whole world listens to what's coming out of here. So we figured if we could make it here, we could make it anywhere.
There's a song on this album I think will speak to many people from lots of different backgrounds, and it's Call Waiting. And it features the amazing Angelique Kidjo. And I just want to play a short clip, and we'll both try not to cry, okay? Let's try to hold it together, okay? Here we go.
By the way, did you get that money gram that I sent? You know it's a struggle here just to pay the rent. Plus the winter's getting colder, now I'm getting older. I think of relocating back to Ghana for good. But hello? Hello, mommy? You're breaking up. Hello?
I know you gotta spread your wings and fly. Call me when you can.
That feels very real to me. I mean, is that how it is for you? There are times you just feel so disconnected from all the people you love, even though you're obviously doing it for a purpose.
Yeah, you know, at least now with Skype and internet, things are a little bit more fluid. But when I first immigrated, I mean, it was phone cards. And, you know, it was never enough minutes to be able to communicate with your people back home. But, you know, you find strength in realizing that you're not the only one, you know, and there are a lot of people who are also going through these challenges. And the goal always is to find a way to return home.
You know, speaking of which, immigration is so much in the news at the moment in lots of places around the world. But in this country, the particular focus has been on the southern border with these young children coming across many times by themselves. And I wondered, even though your path was different, I mean, you went to college, you studied business. Does that story bring anything up for you as an artist?
It does. It does. And absolutely. I mean, you know, regardless of how you immigrate somewhere, you're still an immigrant. I mean, the reality is that the rest of the world has been systematically robbed of opportunity, whether it's through political interference, economic interference. And so you can't create a situation where you are the only one eating and not expect that everybody else that you've deprived of eating would try to find a way, you know, to eat from it. I mean, of course, a lot of it is fleeing violence. A lot of it is fleeing economic hardship. And hopefully, you know, there's the humane part of us that says, okay, you know, put everything aside and figure out that if we're all doing well, then we're all doing well.
Actually, you finished the song Call Waiting with the line, "Now I'm getting older, I think I'm relocating back to Ghana for good." Is that true? Or is that just part of the moment of longing?
That is true. That is true. And I have absolutely made a lot of moves towards that. The ceiling that exists back home for art and culture. I know that my contribution in Ghana can be a lot more effective, you know. And so a lot of us get to that point where we've emigrated somewhere and we realize that I found this dream of mine. How can I start to find a way to make it effective back home?
Well, don't forget us.
Absolutely
Come
would.
Come back and see us.
Absolutely would.
Blitz the Ambassador's latest album is called Afropolitan Dreams. He was kind enough to join us from our bureau in New York City. I hear that you have a treat for us. I am told that you are going to perform A Dollar and a Dream in studio. True?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. And this song, Michelle, is dedicated to you guys and the amazing work that you've done all these years. And yes, it touches my heart. And so this is for you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Come on, tell me more. Yeah. Come on, tell me more. Yeah. Yo, the year's 95 and I'm sitting in a ride seat reclining. Listen to Biggs, ready to dying. I was only 13, my mind and my dream. Memorizing every verse with the rest of my team. We all rocking matching bubble jackets with the brown leather. Yo, who would have thought it was 90 degree weather in Accra City, Ghana, where we rock for the honor. Got off stage, hopped in a tro-tro. Medina, where I stayed, was the reason for the freedom that I craved. Mama banging on my door, asking Jesus, can he save for sure? She could have swore I lost my mind. All alone in my room, spitting rhyme after rhyme after rhyme after. Only if she knew what I'd become. A journey so amazing, like the raisin in the sun. Look at me now, never in this game for the glory. Just a kid from Africa, here to tell my story. And all I had was a dollar and a dream. All I ever had was a dollar. Come on and tell me more. Come on and tell me more. Yeah, yeah. Come on and tell me more. And tell me more. And tell me more. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Tell you more.
2005, New York City, open mics where I earned my stripes, spitting these hot raps with a stack of CDs in my knapsack, posted at Union Square, peddling hand to hand the whole year. The same streets I met my man James on, told me we could take these lanes on. Hustle Hard was the theme song. Late night on the A train, the smell will leave you nauseous. Hanging posters everywhere, to hell with being cautious. Folks used to say, damn, your street team's amazing. I just laughed it up, and just kept waiting. The blog said I wasn't hip hop enough. World Music had said I wasn't African enough. I gave them all the middle finger. Native Son had arrived. Rolling Stones magazine, 4 stars out of 5. Look at me now. Never in this game for the glory. Just a kid from Africa, here to tell my story. And all I had was a dollar and a dream. All I ever had was a dollar and a dream. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Come on and tell me more. Yo, yo, come on and tell me more. Yo, yo, can I tell you more? Yo, yo, can I tell you more? Yo, yo, come on and tell me more. More, more, more. Tell me more. Come on and tell me more. Come on and tell me more. Yeah, come on and tell me more. Yeah, can I tell you more? Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Thank you so much for this opportunity.